Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. This Week in America online, thisweekinamerica.us. We're living in a world of almost unparalleled separation. People are no longer disagreeing, but instead disavowing each other's rights to an opinion, the reluctance to discuss controversial issues dividing us deeply. In his new book, Our Search for Belonging, How the Need for Connection is Tearing Our Culture Apart, Howard Ross explains how to bridge our increasingly polarized society, what is driving this polarization, and how can we overcome it. Howard is a lifelong social justice advocate and the founding partner of Cook Ross, considered one of the world's seminal thought leaders on identifying and addressing unconscious bias. Howard has delivered programs in 47 states, over 40 countries, to audiences including Fortune 500 companies and major institutions within healthcare, government, and nonprofit sectors. Author of the bestsellers Everyday Bias, Identifying and Navigating Unconscious Judgments in Our Daily Lives, and Reinventing Diversity, Transforming Organizational Community to Strengthen People, Purpose, and Performance, and the new book, Our Search for Belonging, How the Need for Connection is Tearing Our Culture Apart. Howard Ross with us on This Week in America. Howard, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Rick, thanks so much. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. This is such an important book, especially now. And you take us to there right in the beginning, the introduction, A Tale of Two Countries. You talk about we are living in a society today that can feel at times like it's coming apart at the seams. Have you ever seen anything like what's going on now in society?
You know, I tell you, I've been around a while, Rick. I'm 67, and so I go back to, you know, I started doing organizing work in civil rights when I was 15 or 16 years old, and I've been engaged in social justice movements for the entire adult part of my life. And for me, it feels much more toxic than I can ever remember it being. I mean, even back in those days, in the 60s, when we had all the social upheaval that we had, we mostly functioned as a bell curve society where you had, you know, for example, you had Northeastern Republicans who were for civil rights. You had Southern Democrats who were against it, even though most Democrats were for it, most
yes.
Republicans against it. You had the anti-war movement. You had Scoop Jackson Democrats who supported the war and then most Democrats against the war, but also Paul McCluskey or Mark Hatfield Republicans who were against the war, even though most Republicans supported it. Now we've moved from that bell curve society to a dumbbell curve society where everything is on the ends and nothing's in the middle, and we've been cleaved into these two tribes. And the real challenge is that in the past, we were mostly issue-oriented. So I might agree with you about civil rights, but disagree with you about gun rights, but agree with you about foreign policy, but disagree with you about financial policy. You know. Now, it's no longer issue-oriented, it's identity-oriented. It's now you're one of those kind of people. And we know from studying the social psychology of this that what happens when we get so separated is a phenomenon called the outgroup homogeneity effect kicks in, where we tend to make the other the same. We're diverse, but they're all the same. And we tend to, and once we've done that, of course, it's easier to dehumanize them, it's easier to stereotype them, it's easier to demonize them, and we don't actually see their humanity at all. And this is happening on both sides.
You know, you talk about communities as being increasingly political enclaves, and when you think about it, places of worship, social organizations, media exposure, that's really driving this divide, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the studies in the book, as you know, is what's called the Whole Foods Cracker Barrel divide.
Yes.
A study that's been done by the Cook Political Report now since 1992. And we know that Whole Foods markets tend to be in more liberal enclaves. Cracker Barrel family restaurants tend to be in more conservative ones. And back in 92, during the first Clinton election, when he ran against, at that time, President Bush, they tracked how the voting patterns were. And they found that there was about a 20-point difference. In other words, people in the liberal enclaves tended to vote 20% more Democratic than Republican, and vice versa in the other groups. Over the years, they've tracked this at every election, and in the last election, that number reached 54%. So what that means is that we're now living in environments where most of the people living around us agree with us. Most of them have the same political point of view, which means that the schools that our kids go to, they're going to school with kids who come from families who agree with them. We're going to shop at places where people likely agree with us. We're going to the barber shop, to the doctor's office. Wherever we go, we're likely surrounded largely by people who agree with us. And so, and then you add to that, of course, if you watch your news station and I watch my news station, because we know there's been this dramatic cleavage over the course of the last 25 years in media, as we've gotten more and more segmented in our media. When I grew up, again, ABC, NBC, CBS was all we had. We
looked
at those three stations and got basically the same news and interpreted it differently. Now we get pre-interpreted news. If you watch MSNBC and I watch Fox, we get completely different news. And so then you throw in your Facebook feed and your Twitter feed and the blogs that you read, and pretty soon we're living in echo chambers of our own creation, and we're assisting in propagandizing ourselves.
It's interesting when you think as you're watching the news. I've sort of gone and talked to people who've sort of gone from looking for information to gravitating towards affirmation, sort of that side, like you just mentioned, you've got Fox on one side, MSNBC on the other, sort of going there because you feel like you sort of belong to that community. And obviously that's a widespread feeling.
And that's exactly what we're saying. That's very well put, Rick. I mean, I think when you said looking for affirmation instead of information, that's exactly what most people do. I mean, you begin disavowing what somebody says before you even have really heard it, because you know where they come from, and therefore they must not have anything valuable to say. I mean, one of the things that really motivated my writing this book was that I've spent most of my life trying to be somebody who really understands the other point of view. I haven't always succeeded, but I've always tried to be that way. It's always been a value that was taught to me by my parents. And I began to notice how I was getting sucked into the us versus them more this time than I ever had before.
Yes.
And that led me to say, well, wait a second, you know, who are these people who I'm stereotyping? Who are these people who are voting for President Trump who I'm stereotyping? So I went out and started to have conversations with people, and it's now over 100 people I've talked to who voted for President Trump, even though I'm decidedly on the, you know, the progressive side of the political spectrum in terms of the ideas and values and you know, policies I support. And what I found was, out of these conversations, is that this is not a homogeneous group of people. This is a very diverse group of people, some of whom are the full-throated supporters you see on TV, but many of whom are just really good, decent people who just have a different value structure than I do, and who you know, may dislike certain things about him, but they still felt compelled to vote for him. 56% told me they voted more against Clinton than they voted for Trump to begin with. And by the way, it's similar on the other side. Because we know that they were the two most unpopular candidates to ever run for president.
Yes.
And people had specific issues in a lot of cases. You know, I didn't like a lot of the way he was, but, you know, I couldn't vote for a candidate who supported abortion, or, you know, I had strong feelings about health care or whatever else, gun control, you know, whatever the issues were. But these were decent people, and some of them I've now developed long-term relationships with, where we continue to debate and discuss and try to understand each other's points of view. It's been an incredibly rich experience.
We're talking about the new book, Our Search for Belonging, How the Need for Connection is Tearing Our Culture Apart. Howard Ross, lifelong social justice advocate, thought leader on unconscious bias, is our guest on the program. Books available at Amazon, of course, wherever books are sold. His website is cookross.com. Link on directly by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You're talking, it's interesting, the one area out there where it's still diverse and becoming maybe more diverse is the workplace environment. Talk about that and the positive role the workplace can play in trying to bring us together, at least listen to another point of view.
Yeah, that's great, Rick. You know, it's funny, if you think about life as we see it today, you know, as I said, you look at the way we're living politically, geographically, we know that, you know, Dr. King said years ago that the most segregated time in America was Sunday morning, and we know that in our religious practices, even though there's been some desegregation, that they're still very segregated racially.
Yes.
We look at schools, and school segregation is almost as bad now as it was in the 1960s. And so one of the few places where we're put together with people who are different from us and forced to work together is in a workplace. You know, you come to work, and you don't get to choose who's in that cubby next to you or that office next to you or maybe even in the same room as you. Your boss just says, y'all get together and get this job done. And there's been some really interesting background research about this. It goes back to a guy named Elliot Aronson, who's considered to be one of the real fathers of social psychology the social science. And Aronson, back in the 60s, was down in Austin, Texas, and he was working with children who are mixed race, who had come in segregated schools, had come out of segregated schools, and desegregation was there, and there were black, white, and Hispanic students, and all of a sudden they were thrown into these classrooms, bringing all that distrust, anxiety, and stereotypical thinking they were there. And so he created a concept called the jigsaw classroom. And what he did was he designed this exercise with the children using jigsaw puzzles, where the only way they could be successful was to work together. In other words, he put a mixed race group of kids at a table, give them the jigsaw puzzle, and say, "You've got to get this task done by such and such time. Go." And at first, you know, at first they struggled. At first, that they were shy, or you know, they would mock each other or taunt each other. But when they were then tested, they realized that if they kept doing that, they wouldn't win. They wouldn't be successful. And so at some point, they started to find ways to work together. And he found that greater interracial harmony came from that. So the workplace actually provides an opportunity for that as well. This person who's next to us, we're put on a project together. We have to find a way to work together with those differences. Not despite, but with those differences. And we might even find that sometimes that having somebody, let's say, from a more liberal and a more conservative perspective, gives us a better way of looking at a problem, because we have two different ways of looking at that problem. We do know that there's research that shows that around racial and cultural differences, that people from identity groups that are different who come together to try to solve a problem actually come up with more solutions and better solutions than smarter and smarter people of the same group who are homogeneous. And so it's really important for us to see the value of this in the workplace today.
And a number of companies are seeing that value. You talk about that in Our Search for Belonging, Target, General Mills. Give us a couple examples of companies that really understand this and are working to have a more diverse workplace.
Sure. Well, General Mills is one. James Momon, who's the chief diversity officer there, is doing some great work with Courageous Conversations. I mean, one of the probably the most forward-thinking in the whole country around this is Target Corporation, and Caroline Wonga, who is the chief diversity officer from Target, who has regular sessions of courageous conversations around various different issues, and invites employees to come and dialogue and to try to get a better understanding of each other, and is doing that all through the organization. One of the great opportunities I had in the book was to interview George Halverson, who's the retired CEO of Kaiser Permanente, who led Kaiser Permanente to the top of their market. And George, who's become a friend, was willing to share the strategy that he used to take even a large corporation like Kaiser and teach people to begin to see it as an us rather than an us and them. And, you know, how can we focus on we rather than me? And so this can be done in organizations, maybe in the workplace, in the best ways possible right now.
You know, it's interesting, you talked before about point of view. When and how did someone's point of view suddenly become like the truth? If it's no longer my point of view, I really believe what I'm saying is the truth, and the person on the other side is wrong. How did that shift occur?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's always true of human nature for most people. Most people sometimes, if not, and some people all the time, that we get very attached to our points of view, and we get very attached to being right. Sometimes we'd rather be right than be happy. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith, the great economist, once said that most human beings, given a strongly held point of view and evidence to the contrary, quickly go about refuting the evidence. I think that that's true.
Yes.
I think what's changed it and what's put it on steroids is the bifurcation of how we get our information today. Because, as I said, it used to be that we would get information from a unitary source. We would all be looking at basically the same information, that we would interpret it differently. Now, we don't even watch the news. We watch people watching the news.
Yes.
We turn on the news and see a panel of people who are already analyzing it for us before we've even known what happened. You know? And then, you know, as I said, it gets supported by social media. People unfriend people who disagree with them, Twitter, you know, all these kinds of things. And so as a result of that, we get more and more and more justified in our point of view, and more justified in demonizing and dehumanizing the other's points of view. And I can get it, you know. I mean, I really want people to understand, I'm not calling for moderation. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be willing to have strong points of view about important issues of the day. Anybody who follows me on social media knows that I have very strong points of view. But we can have strong points of view without demonizing people who support the other point of view. It's one thing to have a strong position about a politician, because politicians put themselves out there to be judged. You know, when President Trump and Hillary Clinton ran for president, they put themselves out and said, "Judge me." So that's free. You know, take a shot. You know,
yes.
Give them their judgment if you want. But it doesn't mean that everybody who voted for those people or who support those people made that agreement. And nor does it mean that everybody who voted for or support those people believe in everything that they say or do. And when we act like they do, when we act like everybody is homogeneous, we give no safe shelter to people other than for people like them. And this reinforces this separation more and more and more.
Yeah, it's us versus them again. Time is going way too quickly. A couple minutes left in the program, not nearly enough time to answer the question, but I'll ask it anyway. What are the consequences if society continues to fuel this divisiveness? And do you have any hope that maybe we can turn this around? You sometimes wonder if we've gone too far.
Well, look, I think it's a good question, and it's a very troubling question, and I think that there are no pretty consequences that I can see. I mean, basically right now both sides think, well, we're going to win this argument, but we see as the Republicans are winning, what happens is you get more and more and more resistance and response from the left. And in fact, the same thing would happen if it switched case. You see, we've got to understand ultimately that whether we like it or not, we're interdependent. Whether we like it or not, we live in the same country. And that same country has to be governed, and we can't very functionally set it up where every 4 or 8 years, one party comes in and puts things in place, the other party comes in and completely undoes those things and puts other things in place, and then the other undoes that, and then the other does that.
Yes.
At some point, as a society, that will cause us to unravel. And so I think, you know, do I have hope? You know, I mean, I'm an eternal optimist, and I do think it's possible for us to do something like this. But I think that it's really important for our listeners to get this core message, which is, I believe, as citizens of this democracy, we can't wait for somebody to do this for us. We have to do, really at three levels, we have to do something about this. First of all, we've got to start building relationships with individuals in our lives who have different points of view. I know you're not going to reach Richard Spencer if you're on the left, or David Duke. You know, those. You know, I'm not talking about the extreme hate mongers, but I'm talking about the people who are kind of in that, you know, they don't necessarily buy all of it, but, they struggle with it.
Yes.
We can reach each other from that standpoint. The second is to work in our organizations and our workplaces. And the third is to choose leaders who may represent our point of view, but also bring in a consciousness about the importance of civility in our society and civil dialogue in our society. And I think all of us could take on those as a challenge.
It's a very important book. The book is titled Our Search for Belonging, How the Need for Connection is Tearing Our Culture Apart. Howard Ross is the author, lifelong social justice advocate, thought leader on unconscious bias. His website is cookross.com. Book available wherever books are sold, and you can link on directly to Howard's website by going to our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Howard, a pleasure having him on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Rick, it's been my pleasure. Love to do it again sometime.
Would love to. I got 5 more pages of questions here, important things that we need to talk about. Howard Ross, our guest. The book is Our Search for Belonging, How the Need for Connection is Tearing Our Culture Apart. You're listening to This Week in America, and we're back after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.